Vermont Leeds, Montpelier, Vermont.
Quad, a quirky little sound. Quadruplets, quadratic. For those of you paying attention in math, quadruple, quad cities, quadrillion, actual word, 1,000 billion. In skiing, quad shows up a few times. Strange. Quadriceps, those muscles that scream back at you early in the season. High-speed quad, magically transporting us to the top of the mountain. And now, the Quad Pack, only from Sugarbush. The Quad Pack is four completely unrestricted all-mountain lift tickets at Sugarbush, Lincoln Peak, and Mount Ellen. Good all season long, no blackouts. And the Quad Pack is only $219. That's right, $219 gets you four tickets to the sweetest terrain in the East, with the ultimate in variety for skiers and riders. But the Quad Pack is only available through November, so buy yours before November 30th, because when December hits, it's gone. Don't wait. Log on to sugarbush.com and get your Quad Pack today. Tell your friends, family, even Uncle Rod, which rhymes with, well, you know. Sugarbush. Be better here.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Thank you, Jim Connie. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. Nice day out there today. Tomorrow's looking kind of nasty. Thanks for spending part of your morning with us. Might be time to get at a Dodge if you can. Coming up on the program today in our second hour this morning, we're going to talk with a gentleman who ran a credit company and a debt service company that had a security breach. Just about the, it's a company that actually works with credit card companies too. One of the worst things that can probably happen to that line of business. We're going to find out how our guest was able to figure it out and also manage to recover as a result too. We'll be taking your phone calls throughout the program. We'll check in with our White House crew to begin hour number two. The big story yesterday actually happened right when we were talking with our White House crew, the departure of Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. A couple of interesting pieces exploring what the implications are of that. We'll take your phone calls at the usual phone numbers this morning. You can reach us at 244-1777. That's 244-1777. Our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255, 877-291-TALK. I know many of you thought I was just playing hooky on Friday when I wasn't here and Ken was filling in, but I was actually up the road in Burlington at a conference on journalism, and one of the speakers at the event was Bill Densmore, who has done a lot of research on the future of journalism, and in particularly he's looked at newspapers, and just, wow, what a decline that industry has had. And Bill's kind enough to join us live on the line this morning. We're going to talk about this, what I think is an important topic, and Bill's going to explain why it should be important for all of us. Bill is a consultant and a researcher, works down with a group called the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute, and he's written a number of papers that talk about the future of journalism, and as I mentioned, he's kind enough to join us live on the line. Bill, thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
Good, and it's great to be on local radio. You all in Vermont are privileged to have a station like WDEV, and I've followed your progress over the years.
Oh, all right. And you can attest to the fact that I was actually at the event on Friday, so I won't get into any trouble.
You were not playing hooky. You were actually working.
Okay, all right. So let's talk a little bit more about your background. You've worked with the Associated Press. You've also been a publisher. Talk a little bit about your journalism background.
Well, I went to UMass Amherst and sort of majored in the student newspaper there. And then worked with the AP in Chicago, San Francisco, and Springfield, Illinois. For 9 years, my wife and I published weekly newspapers in the Berkshires. I live in Williamstown, Massachusetts, which is where I'm talking to you from this morning. And in 93, we sold our weeklies one of the reasons we sold them was because I began to see a train wreck coming for newspapers if they didn't figure out how to be able to give people access to information from anywhere, because with fat pipes, with the internet coming into the home, we'd be able to go anywhere for information. And many, many newspapers have risen to that challenge, but some haven't. And they've been hampered in some ways by the lack of technology to make that sharing possible.
Okay. Talk a little bit about the decline of newspapers. I was just, the numbers you had were staggering. I didn't realize that at one point in this country, there were actually people getting more than one newspaper a household.
Yes. My friend and former colleague, Martin Langeveld, who lives down in the Brattleboro area, keeps track of statistics of the changing fate of the news industry. And before my talk on Friday at the Vermont Journalism Trust meeting in Burlington, he gave some figures. And I forget the exact number, but there was a time shortly after or just before World War II when for every household in America got something like 1.3 daily newspapers, because at that time big cities had many, many newspapers in competition with each other. And so if you lived, as my wife did, for example, in the Chicago area, she can recall getting both the Chicago Daily News and the Chicago Tribune in her family's home growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Now that figure is more down around 30%, 34%, I think, was the number that Martin had. In other words, only one in three American households gets a daily newspaper, and the fear is that that's going to go even lower.
And it's not just the Internet that has destroyed newspapers. What else happened?
Well, and by the way, just as a little coda to what I just said, the picture for weekly newspapers is not that dire. There are lots of weekly newspapers that are still doing quite well, including those that serve your area. And I see that because I serve on the board of the New England Newspaper and Press Association, which involves both dailies and weeklies. Now, repeat your question because I forgot it.
Well, you were talking about the decline of newspapers, and I was saying that it isn't just the Internet, that there were other factors that were in play. So what else caused that decline?
Well, of course, the first thing that made a difference was radio coming in becoming really popular in the 30s. And that took away some of the immediate news audience of newspapers, but it didn't particularly dent their growth. Then television in the 50s made a difference, too. But throughout this time, America was growing. The consumer economy was growing. There was enough audience and enough advertising revenue for everybody. When newspapers really began to hit the skids was in the mid-2000s, when the effect of the Internet started to be shown. But the charts that Martin Langeveld finds and showed to us all on Friday show a very consistent straight drop in newspaper circulation starting in the 50s and coming right through the present. There isn't a particularly steep change in the curve at the time the Internet comes on. It's just a cumulative decline. And nowadays, as of the last year or so, most newspaper websites, most news websites are reporting that more of their traffic is coming from mobile devices than from desktops. So we're becoming increasingly a mobile consumer of news and an audio consumer of news via radio being streamed or podcasts.
We're talking with Bill Densmore. We're talking about journalism. Why, Bill, can companies not get as much money from Internet advertising as from their print advertising?
A one word, competition. When a city was dominated by a single newspaper or a couple of newspapers, the publishers were in the, from a business point of view, enviable position of being a de facto monopoly. It wasn't that they sought to be a monopoly. It was just the economics and the network effect of being the one paper created a monopoly. And so they were able to support pricing for their advertising that was more than sufficient to underwrite the cost of putting out quality newspapers and having extensive newsrooms. But now on the Internet, there are, as we all know, millions and millions and millions of websites. In any community of any size around the country now, aside from the broadcast and print legacy media, there are lots and lots of blogs and Facebook pages which are reporting news in some sense of the word. And so, and all of those sites can take advertising. The rise of Google's networking advertising solution called AdWords and AdSense has made a huge difference in making advertising automated on the web, so that instead of advertising needing to go to a publisher who has assembled an audience, the advertising now finds the audience wherever they are. And so as a result, the so-called CPMs, the cost per thousand to run an ad, has dropped into the range of a dollar or less in some cases for undifferentiated advertising. Now compare that, for example, to the price that newspapers used to be able to charge for freestanding inserts, those circulars that come out in a Sunday paper.
Right.
When I was advertising director of the North Adams Transfer in the mid-90s, I think we were able to charge $30 per thousand of those delivered. So, and I don't, I think there's hardly any websites on the web today that can get $30 a thousand or $30 CPM for anything.
Is there a way for a newspaper, if it just goes digital and just goes on the internet and drops the cutting down the trees and delivering it by trucks, is there an offset there that you can make it?
Well, it definitely cuts out a lot of costs. But the problem is that if the replacement advertising, and key on that word advertising for a minute because I want to come back to it, if the replacement for advertising at $25 or $30 a thousand is advertising at $1 or $2 or $3 or $4 a thousand, then even if you cut half your legacy cost by getting rid of the delivery trucks and the printing presses and all of the accoutrements of those two things, if you can only realize a quarter or a third of the revenue online, then you're not saving yourself. So my view, and I think increasingly the view of people in the industry, is that advertising alone is not going to sustain journalism as we've known it in the digital world. It might sustain something akin to journalism, involving a great deal of community participation and interaction. So what some people used to call citizen journalism. It might support a sort of organized volunteer corps reporting the news, but it probably isn't going to support armies of reporters paid reasonable salaries to provide a watchdog function over government. So there are really four ways today that you can support a website. One is through advertising, and that's the route most websites are taking. Another is through donations and crowdsourcing, crowdfunding. And another option is through philanthropy, philanthropy like the Vermont Journalism Trust, which helps support, for example, VT Digger, which was one of the co-organizers of Friday's event in Burlington that you and I were both at. Another option is subscriptions, but now you start to get into an area where the technology is not that advanced beyond subscriptions on a single website. And then you might go to the notion of akin to the single copy sale of a newspaper, the idea that you might be able to find an information resource on the web and just buy it with one click or one tap and have it charged to a particular account. That particular facility, lots of people have tried that or experimented with it and have called it micropayments, but that doesn't really exist at scale anywhere on the web today.
Does it work, though? I mean, is it a concept that works?
Well, I think it is. In fact, in 1994, I started a company in Massachusetts called a company that became ClickShare Service Corp. CLICKSHARE, ClickShare Service Corp. And we actually developed and patented a technology that would allow for micropayments on the web. But at that time, we couldn't get anybody interested in using it because folks in the news industry were absolutely convinced that advertising was going to support everything on the web.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, ClickShare has refined its business a little bit, and it's in the business mostly of providing user authentication, registration, site access control, and billing. And, for example, the Rutland Herald uses our technology to manage access to its web services.
Okay. How do micropayments work? What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, the definition of a micropayment is a little squishy in the sense that I don't know what the threshold is. But generally, people think of it to refer to purchasing a digital good, in other words, a non-physical good, where the cost of that good is in the pennies, it's sub a dollar. And I would say, I think of micropayments as things in the 10, you know, the 1, 5, 10, 15, 20 cent range. And what distinguishes them from, say, what you might buy with a credit card is you may notice that with the exception of very, very large retailers like McDonald's, most retailers are very uncomfortable accepting a credit card for something that costs less than a couple of bucks. And the reason why is because it costs them about 30 cents or more to process a credit card transaction.
Right. Right.
So if you are on the web buying something that costs 5 cents or 10 cents or 15 cents and you want to use a credit card to do that, first problem is you have to get out your credit card number and type in all those numbers and go through, get it authenticated, and then have it charged. But the second problem is if what you're paying for is, you know, 20 or 30 cents, the person who's charging your credit card is not really going to get any of that money. It's all going to go to processing fees.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a need to come up with a system that uses aggregation to take many, many small purchases and aggregate them to a single periodic charge to a credit card or to your bank account. That's the technology that our company developed in the 90s, but which has not reached scale or gone really mass market yet.
So would that mean that I wouldn't have to be setting up an account at every newspaper I want to subscribe to?
Well, the idea would be to use, without checking in with the Rutland Herald about this, but just use them as a hypothetical example.
Okay.
It would mean that if you had a subscription to the Rutland Herald or the Barry Montpelier or Times Argus, in theory, you could go to other resources on the web that are also participants in the same network. And when you bought a single article or a single download from those other resources, it could be charged periodically to your Rutland Herald account.
Okay. All right. Because you talked a little on Friday about this whole idea that there's a technological block here sort of in this system that needs to get worked out the same way. You talked about how in the days of the railroads that when they were first starting, everybody had to have the same track gauge. And also Visa was another example that you used as sort of a collecting area. So would this work that same way?
Well, yeah, I guess
or is
my
there,
reference to Visa and the railroads was to the idea that any system that would make it easy for you to go anywhere to get information and buy it to a single account from a single account is going to require a high degree of collaboration among a large number of publishers or websites. And that collaboration, you don't want that collaboration to be around price or services because that would raise all kinds of monopoly and antitrust
right.
questions.
Yeah.
What you do want collaboration around is simple marketplace functions that make it easier for the market to operate. And that was the context in which I cited the idea that the railroads in this country agreed a long time ago. I don't really know the mechanism how they did this, but somehow or other they figured out that they all needed to have the same track width because you wouldn't want to get your goods in a rail car going to the end of one railroad's line and then have to offload it and put it on another rail car because the track width is 6 inches different.
Right.
Similarly, all of the electricity in this country is alternating current on the grid, and it alternates 60 cycles per second. It's not direct current. It's not at some other cycle per second. And it gets stepped down to 110 volts, not 220 volts at the house. These are the sorts of technological standards that make marketplaces work and without which things are dysfunctional. When the Internet was begun, Surf and the other people invented something called the TCP/IP protocol, which was a standard method of handling data that moves across the Internet in little packets with common sizes and identifications about what they were and what was inside them and how to reassemble them at each end of the line. So, but what doesn't exist on the internet today is a standard mechanism for managing user identity or managing payments. And that, to me, is what is going to be necessary to get worked out before we can come up with a reliable revenue stream to support journalism that people consider to be of value. Because advertising today, it doesn't work in the mass market on the web anymore. Mass market advertising on the web is dirt cheap, as we were talking about earlier, and won't support much of anything at scale. On the other hand, if we can come up with what a new concept, which I call advisortizing, the idea of advertising that is specific to your interests and needs at the moment in which you see it, and which is based upon the network having an understanding of who you are and what your interests are, but importantly, the network doing that in a way that respects your privacy, that's what we need.
Right
now, Facebook, if you're on Facebook, Facebook knows an awful lot about what you're interested in and what you're clicking on. The problem is that while they keep working at it and trying to gradually get more transparent about it, their basic business model relies upon selling your persona to advertisers and other people.
Right.
And you don't have any, you don't get a cut of that.
Right. But in return, supposedly you get free access to, you know, Facebook doesn't charge you and all the other...
That's the bargain, and the question is whether that's a fair value exchange at this point. And I guess as long as there's not an option, that's not a consideration.
We're talking with Bill Densmore. He's a researcher on the future of journalism. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. You know, I was thinking, Bill, after your talk on Friday over the weekend, I was thinking, why would the public have any interest in having any of this change? They have it pretty good right now. They're getting basically, you know, you can get free information now. You don't even have to buy newspapers anymore. You can kind of just sit back, be passive, and let the information flow.
Yeah. Well, if we can find a way to get to an equilibrium between supply and demand, that could work. Let me explain what I mean, and think about WDEV as an example. You at broadcast radio stations, there isn't any way for you to charge individual listeners as they're listening because you don't know who they are, how many they are, where they are, and you don't have any direct connection with them. Public radio solves that problem by asking people to donate, so they have sort of a voluntary subscription system. But and that has reached some sort of an equilibrium. WDEV sustains itself year in and year out on advertising, and that seems to work. But what we're at now in the print business, and I think this is going to start to affect television in the not-too-distant future, is a disequilibrium where the legacy costs of doing what we've been doing are not supportable by the revenues that are possible in this new technology world. And so the answer to your question is that the public will not continue to get what it's getting today because the entities that are putting it out are reaching to the point where they're not making money anymore. I mean, most newspapers in America are still profitable, but their profit margins are vastly lower than they were 10 or 15 years ago, and there's no evidence to suggest that they aren't going to keep declining through the point where they become unprofitable. And then some of them will go to less than 7 days a week, or they will stop publishing. I mentioned a few minutes ago that I used to be advertising director at the North Adams Transcript in North Adams, Massachusetts. That newspaper no longer exists. In January, it was closed by Digital First Media because it wasn't making money anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's possible that new forms to provide the values, principles, purposes, and services that are provided now by journalism may emerge and fill some amount of the market demand for quality civic information, but we just don't know yet where that equilibrium is going to be reached and whether it will be reached at a point where we still have an informed populace.
Mm-hmm. How thinned out do you think the ranks of journalism has already happened?
Well, here there's a reason for some debate. I wish I committed this number to memory, so I'm going to guess that I have this right, but I don't want to be held to it. I think that in the last 10 years, something like 20,000 newsroom people have been lost out of the U.S. newspaper industry. Now, that sounds like a huge number, but it's also a very big industry and has been. It was at one time the second largest industrial industry in America. And the so you can look at that number and say, wow, that's a whole lot fewer stories being written day in and day out than 10 years ago. On the other hand, there are a lot, there's a ton of people employed in digital information creation, technology, and delivery. And there are now pure play digital websites that are trending a little bit towards being regional news creators. Examples, BuzzFeed, Vice, Huffington Post, outfits like that, that are hiring journalists. Even Google and Facebook do have hired some journalists, although they don't per se have journalism operations. So I don't know that the situation is entirely glass half empty. What's very clear is that the way journalism was supported and delivered is not supporting nearly as many journalists as it used to, and that trend will continue. And the question is, will the public want that service delivered in another way, and will it be supportable?
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, gets back to that question I was asking you before, you know, how you really get the public engaged in this. Obviously, it's something that's important to you. Obviously, it's something that's important to me. But, you know, I don't know how many people really see the changes that, for example, are happening at the Burlington Free Press. They're going to do less state coverage. You know, I don't know if people even care or if they even notice.
Well, as I travel around and I tell people that I'm engaged in researching the future and sustainability of journalism, an awful lot of people react to that in the sense of saying, oh, wow, that's a really big and important problem. They get that. They tend to be older, or maybe that's just because I tend to interact more with people my age rather than millennials. I think that younger folks who've never had a long-term experience with a daily newspaper may not have that same sense. They're finding information somehow, somewhere, with their phone or on the web that meets what they perceive to be their information needs today. Whether they will still be satisfied as they get into their late 20s and 30s, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but I was really struck. There was at one point we were talking about some different news organizations, and the Marcellus Parsons, who used to be the anchor at the local big TV station, as well as a guy who runs a weekly, were both complaining about or talking about how readers and listeners were complaining about stories being too long. And in the case of the TV, they did a series and people were calling and complaining and saying 5-6 minute broadcast as part of a 7 or 8 part series, too much information, too long. I was totally discouraged when I heard that.
Well, it's a very difficult challenge holding people's interest. Yesterday I was reading a story in the New York Times about a podcast which was originated at WBEZ in Chicago, and the NPR affiliate in Chicago, called Serial. And it is a reporter who is chronicling in a series of podcasts, I think each an hour long, the details of a 14-year-old murder case in the Baltimore area. And a podcast, as many of your readers know, is an audio report that you can access over your computer or your mobile device over the internet. So it doesn't it's not a broadcast on the air in the sense that a radio station is carrying it. It's something you can click on your own time and listen to it. Well, this podcast has gotten millions and millions and millions of listens since the reporter started it several months ago. And I think the point is, if there are people who are willing to spend an hour every week over many weeks listening to, theoretically, I guess, a news account of an old murder, that tells you that narrative journalism about compelling topics will hold people's interest. Mm-hmm. I remember Marcellus, if I pronounced his name right, the retired Channel 3 news director. I remember what you're talking about. He was saying that they had spent a lot of money and sent a crew to six states to learn about how other states financed education because they wanted to compare and contrast it to the way Vermont was doing so. And he said he was discouraged that they only got 25 letters or emails about that series. And I think there is always going to be somewhat of a disconnect, perhaps, between the information that people want to know and the information that people need to know.
Right.
Sometimes people don't even know the information they need to know until you tell them what it is. And this is part of the problem with the funding of journalism in the sense that there's a public service element of journalism that always has been. It says that that doesn't make it easy to fund from a business plan, user value proposition, all the kinds of words that venture capitalists and Silicon Valley libertarians use to describe successful businesses. I don't know how much time people at Facebook or Google spend thinking about giving people information they need. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, without regard to its commercial value, hopefully some significant amount of time.
Let's go to Stowe. Don, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for taking my question. Your guest is speaking primarily of what I would say are smaller papers, like the one in North Adams, for example. And I'm wondering if there isn't a better opportunity for what you would probably call major market papers. And I'm talking Boston papers. I suspect in North Adams, they probably took a lot of hitting from the Berkshire Eagle and some of the larger papers in that area.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that transcends when you go to a national paper like USA Today, but the amounts he's talking for inserts strike me as really small. And of course, the paper doesn't get any profit out of printing the insert in a lot of cases. They're printed by somebody else, brought to the paper to insert for from what he's describing, an extremely small amount. And yet, my younger daughter works for an advertising firm in D.C., and she was responsible for putting together a full-page ad by the AARP in USA Today a week ago tomorrow. And my understanding from her was that the cost to print that ad, a full-page ad in USA Today, was $180,000. That, to me, is a huge amount. And obviously, they've got to have some good circulation figures to be able to justify that.
Yeah.
But it would strike me that the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, and whatnot are going to be able to generate that kind of income, if indeed they can pick up the slack in some of the rural, smaller communities that have lost daily papers. But whether they can do that, I just don't know. I don't know that much about the industry.
You got to sell a lot of cupcakes to justify $180,000.
Exactly my point.
Wow.
That figure
right. Just
floored me.
Let me get Bill to comment. Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Well, I'm sure I've done the math right, but I think that would be $18 per thousand or an $18 CPM, which is not an astronomical number because USA Today has over a million circulation. And as you know, it also is appearing parts of it in the Burlington Free Press now, too. $30 a thousand for inserts is actually an extremely profitable proposition for newspapers, because the only thing they have to do with the insert is insert it in their paper, and that costs anywhere between $3 and $5 per thousand for the cost of either a mechanical inserting machine or having real people do it. So it might surprise you, but one of the reasons that North Adams Transcript continued to publish as long as it did was because it still had a lot of inserts. And also, the North Adams Transcript, at the time it was closed, was actually owned by the Berkshire Eagle, the same company that owns the Berkshire Eagle, which is part of the reason why it was closed, is the Eagle consolidated that circulation into its own circulation.
We're talking with Bill Densmore. He's a researcher on the future of journalism. You know, Bill, one of the things I'm sort of fascinated about here in Burlington, or in Vermont, is that we have two major news organizations, Vermont Digger, which is really all online, depends on a lot of contributions, has some advertising too. And then you've got 7 Days, the weekly, which is really quite profitable, has this huge Wednesday print paper, also has a significant presence online. Two totally different models.
Well, I think that that Vermont, I think both of them have an advantage in that, well, Vermont Digger has an advantage in the sense that Vermont at 650,000 people is not that large a state population-wise, and so Vermont Digger can extend its reach and its influence and its support across a whole state. And so, in a sense, in Vermont, state news is local news. So that helps Vermont Digger. One of the reasons I think 7 Days is doing so well is that Burlington is a college community. Another reason is that it has had a tremendous advantage through the trials and tribulations of the free press. And it's also, from looking at it, must be very well managed. But all weeklies around the country are not all that healthy for the most part. Because the alt-weekly audience used to be millennials. It used to be people in their 20s and 30s. And now that audience is pretty much migrated to the web for all of the services and features that were typically in an alt-weekly in the past. So I think what 7 Days has been able to do is move itself out of the market class of an alt-weekly into being a sort of general news weekly for the Burlington metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm. Boy, it must be tempting for them to try to go after that daily market that the free press is leaving behind. Would you recommend that they not, or that they should?
Well, I would recommend that they not. I don't know what daily market... I don't know that the daily market is a growth market anymore. I mean, I'd be focusing on the minute-to-minute market. That is to say, nowadays, people have a different expectation of the news. They want it on their iPhone or Android device the moment it happens. Last night, when the Ferguson jury's decision came out, there were tens of millions of people who knew about it instantly because they got a text message on their phone from one news organization or another.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to wait to see that in the morning paper? I mean, maybe the morning paper will have some analysis of the decision, but more than likely that analysis was available the night before on the web, too. So I think that I personally think there's still a huge value and opportunity in print, but I don't know that value and opportunity is in printing daily.
Mm-hmm. Even on the web?
Well, I don't know what you mean by printing daily on the web. I mean, the web,
web by
its nature is constant.
Yeah, I guess I'm saying more blog posts than tweets.
Okay. Yes, I think a website that is on top of breaking news and substantive news as quickly as journalists can create it and have it be trustworthy and accurate that's a business model, particularly if the website has a niche so that they aren't fighting with hundreds of other news content websites.
Let's go to Callis Peter. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm really interested in this and thinking about how my reading habits have changed over the last 40 years. I'm 66. And 30 years ago, I was spending a half an hour to an hour a day reading the newspaper, but I wasn't listening to shows like yours. I might spend half an hour in the evening occasionally listening to the television news like Walter Cronkite. But now I spend, well, I skim Vermont Digger every day. I read the Bridge in 7 days because they only come out once a week. And I can take the time to do that, but I'm feeling overwhelmed by what seems to be more of a news magazine than really news, more and more. I don't watch television because I can't stand that, but still, I'm going from spending half an hour to an hour a day to spending several hours a day, and then that's on top of me looking up the fun things to look up on the internet.
Is that why you say you feel overwhelmed?
I think it's just everything just keeps on adding up. And I remember reading Alvin Toffler's Future Shock 35 or more years ago and how the world is just going to keep on getting more and more and more of everything. And that's what I feel. And I feel like, you know, it would be great to be able to, in many ways, I'd like to go back to that 30 years ago of spending half an hour to an hour a day reading the local news in a local newspaper, but I just feel overwhelmed by everything else.
Mm-hmm. You don't feel like this program doesn't overwhelm you, I hope.
I love to listen to your program, but I fit it in between other things. Mostly I just drove to the post office to get the mail, and that's how I got started listening.
Well, the beautiful thing is you can be doing other things at the same time.
To a certain degree, yeah. But I find I screw up a lot if I pay too much attention, too. So it's I have to take the time off to listen to her to be driving in the car.
Okay. All right. Hands free, of course.
Mark, it's yeah. Bill. I wonder if I asked the caller when he talked about the idea of it felt like he's reading a magazine. Can you elaborate, sir, a little more on what you meant by that?
No, I'm sorry. We lost him in the woods.
Okay. Well, I think the caller, this sense, this anxiety of information overload, I think is a feeling that many of us have, that the caller expressed. And I think that one of the emergent trends you're going to see in the coming years is internet, web, mobile services, which help people discover and sort through the information that matters to them and sort of digest it for them so that they have at least the option of cutting down the amount of time they have to spend culling information every day to get what they need to get through their life. Mark, you probably remembered at the end of my presentation on Friday, I showed a prototype of a service that I'm working on with the Reynolds Journalism Institute's collaboration and a partner in New York called Lifestream. And what it's designed to do is you take a few minutes to describe what kind of person you are, what your personality is, and then our technology goes out and calls from social media the most influential information about subjects that should interest your personality,
right,
and presents that to you in the context of whatever affiliate is offering it. So, for example, if WDEV wanted to offer this live stream service, you could add WDEV's curation of local and regional news to this package, which would include then the personalized content of the that connects well with the way a particular user has self-identified their personality interests.
Yeah,
and
we think
that's a potentially a step forward, but we're just getting into the prototyping stage of it now.
I think you really were onto something with this whole idea that you could really have one place you go to that's figured out really what your interests are, you know, feed you some news, maybe a little sports, but figures out, you know, you want stories about the Yankees, and then you have that, you don't have that overwhelming feeling.
Right.
Let me take a call from Williamstown. Tom, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Mark. I was just calling to say the newspaper deal. I mean, my mom and dad had the Times Argus for like 50 years, and I finally just, it's gone up to like a dollar now, and there's nothing in it. And you start to read a story, and then it says, you know, the story continues on the internet or whether on their webpage. I try to, and as far as television news, I think what's really sad is if you want to know the true news of what's going on in the world of the United States, is you have to tune into the BBC broadcast of the news. You find out more about what's going on in the U.S. other than what Kim Kardashian's doing by following the BBC. So they got the rest of it's off the internet, so I guess they'll probably have to figure something out.
Yeah. All right. Let me have Bill comment on that. Bill, anything you want to comment on that?
I didn't hear a question, so I'm not sure what to say.
Okay. All right. Let me take another call. Let's go to Corinth Forbes. Good morning.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good.
You from a consumer. The written word, or the newspaper as we used to know it, is almost moving into the area of being a dinosaur. I mean, what's written in the morning at noon is old hat. Even like your program, I can be doing something else and monitoring or listening to what you're doing. But I think it's going to wind down to basically niche type of newspapers. I don't think they'd be on a daily basis, but they'll cover stories that you can get down and read, and they won't deal with the instant moment happenings, because they do change. It's very volatile today.
Do you have a question?
Ask the caller, Mark, if he could describe whether there is a form or function of the newspaper that he thinks is sustainable. And also, considering the earlier caller who talked about sort of information overload, what would this caller find to be an ideal information service to help him get through his day? How would he imagine that to be like?
All right. Forbes?
Well, anything that you can enhance yourself with. You could even take, let's say, news breaking stories and then do a more in-depth, more of an unbiased opinion of the thing. So you might get more of the meat rather than just the flash. And anything, again, that you can walk away from and enhance yourself. Editorials on various issues or informational scopes.
Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question, Bill?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Thank you, Forbes. I appreciate it. Let's go to Waterbury. Bill, good morning.
Hey, Mark, it's Biddle Duke at the Waterbury Record.
Oh,
and the Story Reporter. How you doing?
Morning, Biddle.
I just thought I'd weigh in here. I publish two weekly newspapers, and I think they're highly curated and very niche. I think weekly newspapers, we don't break that many stories. In fact, we probably break almost none. My circulation at both newspapers has held strong. So Reporter is a paid publication, the Waterbury Record's free. Both of them are doing very well. They're deeply supported in both communities. Bill was talking about a curated media in the future. Well, you know, that's what my editor does for both papers. And he curates for an audience that is dying, you know, that really wants the information that we produce, because it's what's going on right in front of, you know, all around them in the communities that they care about. So anyway, I think weekly newspapers are going to have to deal with this transition. But I think, you know, if we nurture them and we do them right, both in print and online, it's a market and a kind of journalism that will persist into the future. It's a comment.
Are most of your readers still doing print or online?
You know, our paid circulation in Stowe in my 17 years of ownership basically is the same as it was now than it was 17 years ago when I took over. And in Waterbury, our circulation is growing as the community grows. We also put almost everything online, and And we get a lot of traffic online. So I can't really tell you exactly how it breaks down, but we see, you know, we see pretty good numbers online, and the papers get picked up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let me have Bill comment. Thank you, Biddle. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, Bill, thanks for calling in, because I think you're an example of a poster child for the fact that generalizations don't always hold true. As I said at the beginning of the call, I sit on the board of the New England Newspaper and Press Association, and the difference in the condition of mid-sized dailies versus weeklies in profitable communities like Waterbury and Stowe is stark. And you are an example of the argument that local journalism told by people who are close to the community has tremendous staying power. It is interesting to figure out how weekly publishers such as yourself address the challenge of meeting the information needs of your communities online. For example, I don't know about you, but in Williamstown, Massachusetts, where I live, a lot of people now get chicken dinner, nuts and bolts, what's happening and who did what to who information from their Facebook news feeds.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to have to hear you talk about the extent to which you consider Facebook to be a competitor online.
Yeah, he's gone too now out in the woods.
Okay.
Yeah. That is, I heard that on Friday too. It's pretty amazing how you have communities, literally, it's almost like their Facebook page becomes a local newspaper.
Right.
You know, amazing. How hopeful are you about all this, Bill? I mean, how hopeful are you that 5-10 years from now that there will be a thriving journalistic community?
I'm fairly hopeful. I think we are entering a dour period here, but I think we'll come through it on the other side. I think it's going to take people who care about journalism collaborating and figuring out some solutions. I think I am quite optimistic that the general public understands the importance of journalism and will support it if the value is clearly created, clearly conveyed to them, and if it is made very, very simple and easy for them to pay for. I think that's the biggest challenge we have now, is making it very, very simple and easy to pay for.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you for your time this morning. Thanks for taking longer than I told you I would. I appreciate that very much.
Well, I appreciate what you do. This is a hallmark. I mean, what you do really is journalism, and I appreciate the fact that you're doing it day in and day out.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you saying that, and thanks for your time this morning. Bill Densmore is a fellow with the Reynolds Journalism Institute. He's also on the board of Journalism That Matters, spoke at a conference on Friday. We'll take a quick commercial break back after this.
Attention deal hunters. Traditions run strong in Vermont, and two of the strongest are Vermonters' love for hunting and Chevy trucks. Hi, this is Steve Sace from McMahon Chevy in Morrisville.
And I'm Ed Dever, sales manager at McMahon. Through the end of November, show us your Vermont hunting license and get a $500 gift card to Cabela's with the purchase or lease of any new in-stock Chevy truck. See dealer for details.
At the new McMahon Chevy Buick, our goal is to become Vermont's number one Chevy truck dealer. We've got tons of new Silverados in stock. 1500s, 2500s, many with plows ready to go. We also have a nice selection of the all-new Colorado, the hot new redesigned mid-size pickup truck.
No matter what you're driving, we want to see what you get this year. For the month of November, if you stop by and show us your deer, your moose, your caribou, your gazelle, you'll get a $25 gas card just for showing us.
Dude, no one's going to get a gazelle.
You never know. Check out our inventory online at McMahonChevrolet.com and like us on Facebook for more of our crazy offers.
The new McMahon Chevy Buick on the corner of Route 15 and Route 100 in Morrisville. We make deals the other guys won't. Chevy, find new roads.
Thinking about doing some projects on your home? A home improvement loan from Granite Hills Credit Union is the answer. It's quick and easy. Borrow up to $10,000 with this personal loan at a great fixed low rate. No appraisal or title search required. Remodel your kitchen, replace your roof, or add a room. You decide. Looking to do a larger project? We have home equity loans with new lower rates or a line of credit that allows the flexibility of check writing. Give us a call, stop in, or visit us at granitehills.org to find out how you can make your remodeling dreams come true.
Granite Hills Credit Union is an equal housing lender and is federally insured by the NCUA.
All right, come in. Next hour, we're going to chat with the author of a book, also who ran a credit debt service, had the great misfortune to have his company total computer breach. Find out what happened on that, how the company was able to recover. This also almost completely wiped this dude out financially, personally, because of his business. So we're going to get the story behind the story on that one. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we have a really interesting guest who's written a book about carbon and this whole idea of a carbon tax, which has been proposed and talked about here in Vermont as well, too. So we'll chat about that coming up on the program tomorrow. I'll be off Thursday and Friday. Friday, Ken will be in, and then I'll be back on Monday. We'll take a break here for news in just a moment. We'll hear from our White House crew, and then we'll talk about credit breaches. That'll be coming your way next hour. Keep your dial right here. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is coming your way right now.